Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps.
Would you say that prayer almost sort of presupposes a sort of telepathic medium, or is that going too far? The sense that what I'm thinking here somehow goes to God?
No, I don't think it's a stretch. I think if insofar as I'm praying, and I pray every day, and I'm sure you do too, and many people listening to us may do as well, insofar as one's praying silently, the prayer presupposes that God can hear and respond to our prayers, even though they're silent, even though they're in English. And if people pray in Portuguese or Spanish or Japanese, then the assumption is that God can understand all languages and that these prayers are comprehensible to God. God can hear them, acknowledge them, be aware of them in a way that has to be rather like telepathy. And also, if you think about it, if I'm praying for a friend who's sick, who lives 100 miles away, I'm asking God to bless or heal that person. Then I'm asking God through prayers in my mind. Then either God has to be able to work at a distance, or my intention for that person connects me to that person and brings them into God's presence through my prayers. But there's a linkage across space when you're praying for someone. All of us can pray for people who are not in the room with us or situations that are remote from us at a distance. And this, therefore, means that there's a connection across space through our prayers and our intentions, which is, if not telepathic, akin to telepathy. Telepathy involves people picking up intentions at a distance, like my intention to call on the phone. And prayers are about intentions that we're sharing with God or asking God to help realize, or bringing before God, to put it most neutrally. And so I think intentions reach out beyond our brains to affect what we're intending.
I'm just kind of wrestling with this idea that this taboo originated from a sort of materialistic paradigm that's infiltrated science. Do you think that that's also the cause of why the church in some sectors has been reluctant to admit the existence of this phenomena as well?
Yes. I think that most modern Christians, especially in Protestant countries, have been heavily influenced by the scientific worldview, that have simply absorbed most of this from the surrounding culture. And if you go to traditional Roman Catholic countries, southern Italy, or Orthodox countries like Greece, people don't have a problem with telepathy and psychic phenomena. They're just part of traditional folk culture. People don't have a problem with telepathy in India or in Africa. And there are, after all, there are millions and millions of Christians in Africa. It's just taken for granted that this is part of life. This is going on. It's not seen as particularly pro or anti-religious. It's just the way that things are. And so I think that any taboo that exists in modern Christian denominations is simply absorbed from, ironically, absorbed from the atheistic materialist culture within which we're all embedded. I don't think of anything in the Bible that is against telepathy. There are certainly things against spirit mediums in the Old Testament, Saul and the Witch of Endor, but I can't think of anything that is against telepathy. In fact, it's rather taken for granted. You know, when Jesus says, I forgot which disciple he sees under the fig tree, and then says, I saw you under the fig tree. And the disciple says, you're truly the Lord. And he says, oh, are there many greater things than this? He's rather dismissive of something that could be, in fact, a telepathic impression. So there's nothing in the life of Jesus that suggests he was against psychic phenomena. He was highly intuitive. And when St. Paul and the road to Damascus has his blinding light and he falls down blind, then when in Damascus, again, I've forgotten the name of the person who's praying, who gets the message that he should go to Paul and welcome him and greet him because this has happened. And you could say it's been mediated through directly through God, but you could say there's also a kind of telepathic link that something's happened to St. Paul, this other person picks it up and responds to it. They're both connected through prayer. But again, there's this link at a distance connecting them. and there's nothing in the New Testament suggests there's anything wrong with that. It's just taken for granted that these kinds of things are possible.
I thought it was interesting that you brought up some of the more spiritualist Endor type stuff. Do you think it's perhaps that we've come to associate telepathy with spiritual mediums and more New Age phenomenon, that we've, as Christians and the church, felt like we had to distance ourselves from that? But when you actually look at the phenomenon of telepathy in and of itself, apart from these broader movements, there's not really that much to take issue with.
No. Well, I mean, I can certainly see the reasons for not wanting to get involved with spiritualistic communications with the dead. I mean, I don't do that myself, and I don't advise people to do it. Apart from anything else, I think it's probably rather disruptive for the dead, you know, to be disturbed on their journey, dragged back to a seance room somewhere. So spirit mediumship is a very different thing from telepathy. There are a limited number of people who claim to have these gifts as spirit mediums. I mean, it's quite rare. Whereas telepathy is extremely common, and it's, you know, common among dogs and cats and numerous other species of animals. It's got nothing to do with spirit mediums. But I think that could possibly be one reason why people have sort of tried to lump it together with, you know, it's the kind of thing witches might have been able to do, and therefore it's sort of possibly diabolical or something. But it seems to me a very tenuous line of argument, and one that's unnecessarily motivated by fear, because I think it's normal, natural, and perfectly biological. So I think, yes, I think that could be one reason why some people have this taboo. But mainly, as I say, I think it's because it's picked up in the modern Western world from the scientific materialism that surrounds us. And so I say it's very, very rare to find this taboo in other cultures among Christians.
One final question. I know I've been pressing you to align this idea of telepathy with a religious framework, even though it is a purely biological phenomenon. But one place where I did see in your work that you really entertain and really sort of bring the two together was your book, Physics of Angels, that you wrote with Matthew Fox. And I thought that was just a fascinating work. And I was curious if as a final sort of send-off, if you could tell us a little bit of what place do you see of angels in this organic view of the cosmic? What place do angels hold?
Well, what Matthew Fox and I do in our book on angels is look at the classic Western texts on angels. Dionysius the Areopagite, a 6th century Christian theologian, Hildegard of Bingen, a medieval visionary abbess, one of the most powerful religious women voices from the Middle Ages, and St. Thomas Aquinas. Their view of angels is, of course, much more nuanced than a kind of New Agey, sort of an angel helped me when my car broke down type of story. We're dealing here with a cosmic phenomenon, and what Aquinas and these other thinkers saw was that angels were minds or intelligences lower than the divine level, but higher than the human level, or at least different from the human level, whose job it was to govern and organize aspects of the natural world. So there are 9 levels of angels according to this medieval classification. It starts with cherubim, seraphim, and thrones, which are the angels of the divine love, divine presence, and divine knowledge. And they're like cosmic principles of love, presence, and knowledge of God. And then there's dominions, virtues, and powers, which are celestial angels, which organize the heavenly bodies, the stars, and the planets. And according to the medieval view, these stars and planets were living beings. They were alive. And they were governed by intelligences. The angels, the angel of, say, Jupiter or the star Sirius, would be like the mind of that star, which would help to guide it and govern it. So they were really forms of consciousness beyond the human level. And then there were the angels that governed whole areas of the earth, principalities, continents, and archangels governing whole groups of people, and then individual angels for individual people like guardian angels, and also for plants and animals. The angels were these intelligences that governed and influenced nature, including us. So our own guardian angels, according to that view, are not just an isolated phenomenon in an otherwise mechanical universe. They're part of a universe that's full of life and intelligence. So the one reason that Matthew Fox and I wrote this book was to recover a sense of animated nature, nature, living nature, which is what the world in which Jesus grew up, the world of the Old Testament, nature's alive, not dead and mechanical. In the Middle Ages, the theology definitely saw nature as animate. The animals and plants were living beings with souls, not necessarily immortal souls like the human, but the very word animal comes from the Latin word anima, which means soul, as in animate beings. So again, the idea that the only kind of spirituality, mind or consciousness confined to humans and then to human brains is again, ironically, a product of modern Western materialist science, not a traditional Christian doctrine. And angels remind us of this much larger and more mysterious worldview, full of life and energies with which we interact, with which God interacts. But some of them are not primarily about humans. The ones that govern the heavens, the angels governing the heavens, are really about keeping the whole order of nature going. And then they can appear to us giving messages or visions, as they do repeatedly. There's hundreds of examples of angels in the Old and the New Testaments. Again, they were taken for granted as beings. Of course, the main emphasis there is on ones that interact with humans and give messages. And the very word angel in Greek comes from the word for messenger. But the vision that our Christian predecessors had was much wider than that, because they were so involved as animating principles, as intelligences, as creative principles in nature. And interestingly, one of the founders of the theory of evolution, Alfred Russel Wallace, who, like Charles Darwin, thought up the idea of natural selection, was quite unlike Darwin in his interpretation of evolution. Instead of saying that evolution happened by chance or through blind forces or in a kind of materialistic way, Wallace thought that natural selection weeded out unsuccessful organisms. I mean, that's pretty much common sense. But he thought that creative power was a creative intelligences working through nature. And he didn't think that God did everything directly. He thought that God's creativity was expressed in the evolutionary process through the guidance of the angels. And in his last book, The World of Life, 1921, he actually describes how he thought of angels as guiding and as being creative principles, guiding animals and plants in the evolutionary process and being a source of inspiration and creativity to them. Now, in all of this, of course, these angelic intelligences are rather mysterious, but they're certainly not humanoid beings with colored wings as seen in stained glass windows. I mean, they may appear to some people in that form, but that's not how traditional Christian thinkers have thought about them. They thought about them in a much more sophisticated and in my opinion, more interesting way.